The reading today is a ritual to read to each other a poem by William Stafford. And if you'd like to follow along, the poem is printed in the order of service. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there's many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders the circus won't find the park, I call it cruel and maybe the root of all cruelty to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep.
Before I begin, I do want to reiterate, I'm going to do this until you're tired of hearing it. Just deep gratitude for the welcome that my family has felt since being here. We've been here about 3 weeks now, and it's not hard to see why this community has grown both in depth and in numbers over the years. I mean, we have really felt welcomed here and are in your debt for that. So, thank you. Transitions are never easy, and yet transitions are always around us and within us. Ask any Buddhist or any biologist, and they will tell you that you are a system constantly in flux, and you are part of a larger system also constantly in flux. In fact, no matter how large or small our view may be, whether we're viewing atoms or animals, ecosystems or planets, change seems to be a given. In general, things are more likely to change than to stay the same. So, why is change so hard? Why do transitions often leave us feeling uneasy or insecure? These are questions that, perhaps for obvious reasons, are very much on my mind and heart these days. As many of you know, we just moved here from New Jersey, by way of St. Paul, by way of New Jersey. In the past 5 years, Jen and I have gone through many, Jen is my wife, and we've gone through many transitions together. Some of them will be familiar to you. We got married. We became parents. Two things that I thought were momentary transitions, but I've, of course, found them to be ongoing. Yes. Nice to know there are other parents and spouses in the crowds. We've lost a parent and two grandparents. We've each changed careers, and I completed grad school. We've moved 5 times from New Jersey to New York City, back to New Jersey, then to St. Paul, and now here to Appleton. This is the life of a young minister, I think. Throw in an ankle reconstruction that I had a few years ago, a few new jobs, 3 at very different UU congregations. And we now live about 1,000 miles from our support network. And you get the picture. We've had quite a bit of transition. And so all of this transition, of course, is also set against the backdrop of our culture and the fact that our economy is going through massive transition. Politically, we've all seen some pretty drastic transition also. And so it hasn't been easy for us. And I am tired. Not just physically tired, but also spiritually tired. What I mean by that is that I feel like my faith has been tried over and over and over again in the past 5 years. I mean that every time we've gotten settled, whether it be into a particular place or into a particular identity, we've very quickly thereafter faced another transition. This has been true, like I said, personally, politically, economically. Surely this trend won't continue forever, we hope, and Jen and I are very much looking forward to digging our hands in the dirt for a while. But this brings me to the topic of my sermon this morning. Amidst all this transition, which way is home? Amidst all the change, where can I rest my religious trust? Where is a safe foundation upon which to build my faith? I should let you know here that I like to put kind of double meanings into some of my sermon titles. So I'm just going to plant that seed and we'll see what grows from it as we continue here. So questions like these are mine of the moment, but they are common to us all. All humans must grapple with questions of faith and meaning. For some, the quest for existential security is enough to be driven to close traditions of doctrine or orthodoxy. To me, this is the easy way out, that of adopting external answers to internal questions. Other people, notably religious liberals like us, do not seek in our faith the absence of mystery or doubt. Rather, we seek a foundation of faith that accounts for our doubt, that is honest with the limitations of our knowledge while also offering comfort when we need it. And so my reply to my earlier question is refreshingly simple. Perhaps the way itself can be a home. We'll dive into this a little bit more, but I first want to share with you a poem. This poem was written by a favorite minister of mine, not a favorite poet, but it's still his poem, and you can make of that what you will. It was written by a minister named Ken Patton, who was a Universalist minister and a humanist at the sort of middle of the 20th century. He was also a longtime minister of a congregation that I kind of call my home congregation in New Jersey. Very interesting fellow. I'd love to have a conversation about him some other time. This is a poem of his called The Way. I must live my own way, refusing all that binds. I must know my own mind among all other minds. I must do my own deeds, and in whatever lands, I will know my own hands among all other hands. I must forsake the crowds and walk with lonely fools to seek for my own face in bleak, deserted pools. I must leave worn old roads to walk on hillside grass, to follow my own feet out in the wilderness. The wilderness is where we find ourselves when we find ourselves amidst transition. Faith can be hard to find in the wilderness. One only need read the Exodus stories or any of the religious mystics to taste the struggle of maintaining faith while away from home. Now, before I go on, I want to spend a few minutes teasing out this idea of faith. Faith is not an easy word for many religious liberals to hear, much less identify with. After all, too often faith seems to be what helps people get past the lack of proof. When something is unbelievable, in order to believe it anyway, sometimes people call on faith. We ask people to take things on faith when we ask them to trust us without proof. Well, surely this has also been the habit of the organized church for many years, requiring the religious trust of believers while presenting little evidence of why it is deserved. As free-thinking UUs, we tend to reject this process, for good reason, I would say. We know that for a religion to be true, it must make sense to the individual heart. We know that this means that we will often come to different conclusions, different beliefs, and different practices. And while we hold some practices in common when we gather, like lighting the chalice, we also honor the religious diversity that is always among us, as individuals making sense of individual lives, but each with clues about the whole of which we are all a part. There's a theologian by the name of Paul Tillich who actually was writing in a similar time period as Ken Patton, middle of the 20th century. Also, interestingly, about the same time period that this fellowship was founded. He was wrestling with this word called faith at a time of pretty strong cultural conformity. There's a book, you have two copies in your library. It's called Dynamics of Faith. His introductory remarks are these. There is hardly a word in the religious language, both theological and popular, which is subject to more misunderstandings, distortions, and questionable definitions than the word faith. It belongs to those terms which need healing before they can be used for the healing of people. Today, the term faith is more productive of disease than of health. It confuses, misleads, creates, alternately skepticism and fanaticism, intellectual resistance and emotional surrender, rejection of genuine religion and subjection to substitutes. Indeed, one is tempted to suggest that the word faith should be dropped completely. But desirable as that may be, it is hardly possible. A powerful tradition protects it, and there is as yet no substitute expressing the reality to which the term faith points. So for the time being, the only way of dealing with the problem is to try to reinterpret the word and remove the confusing and distorting connotations, some of which are the heritage of centuries. Personally, I think that could have been written yesterday. Tillich said, he defined faith as the most centered act of the human mind. His words were also the call to gather. Faith is more than trust in even the most sacred authority. It is participation in the subject of one's ultimate concern with one's whole being. He broadly defined faith as the state of being ultimately concerned. An ultimate concern is just that, concern about what in life is ultimate. It is the process by which we as individuals continue to refocus our lives upon what is important, continue to deepen our understanding of words like love and peace and justice, ultimate concerns that we can be sure will outlive our frail bodies. Tillich used his language of ultimate concern to distinguish between faith and knowledge. The most ordinary misinterpretation of faith, he said, is to consider it an act of knowledge that has a low degree of evidence. If this is meant, one is speaking of belief rather than of faith. He continued, almost all of the struggles between faith and knowledge are rooted in the wrong understanding of faith as a type of knowledge, which has low degree of evidence but is supported by religious authority. That was what he called static belief. The alternative, and also the title of his book, Dynamics of Faith, is a dynamic religion of faith, one that is based on the changing nature of reality. A dynamic religion of faith allows for different points of entry and multiple interpretations of the divine. In his words, the content matters infinitely for the life of the believer, but it does not matter for the formal definition of faith. Put perhaps more simply, it's not the particulars that matter. It's the universal. And all these particulars point to the universal. The only thing that matters in a dynamic life of faith is that we keep focused on concerns that are ultimate, that we keep struggling with meaning and communicating our struggles with one another, with the knowledge that no individual's glimpse of the whole is complete. Tillich's definition of faith is not far off from that of the universalist theologian Forrest Church. Has anyone here read any of Forrest Church's work? A couple folks? Okay. He had a pretty simple definition for religion. He said, religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. So Church uses this word religion, where sort of in the same way that Tillich uses faith. The implication is the same. As humans, we are bound not by our outer beliefs or doctrines or creeds. We are bound not by allegiance to tradition or nation. Rather, we are irrevocably and deeply bound by the condition of our very creation. by this inward process common to us all, by the fact that we all struggle to make sense of our lives before we die. We're going to sing a hymn later that kind of gets at this in different language. It says, we celebrate life's mystery, we celebrate death's truth. Every human, simply by being born, is tasked with making sense of life with the tools that are available to her or him, tools like tradition and experience, language and symbols. So if we accept this open definition of faith and religion, what does it mean for us when we experience transition in our lives? Further, what does it say about how we gather, how we come together in our myriad different journeys? By understanding faith as a process, not a destination or something that can be achieved, we come to see that every transition, those we might call good, those we might call bad or painful, every transition is an opportunity for the development of a dynamic faith. Therefore, the doubt that often accompanies painful transitions is not unique to any of us as we go through these moments. Rather, the doubt is a basic fact of life. Nor is doubt opposed to a life of faith, which is something that I think is kind of lifted up these days. You can't have faith and doubt at the same time. In fact, a life surrounded by mystery and process, as ours is, seems like doubt is the perfect and healthiest response. Any faith that's honest to the fact of life must include some doubt. After all, as the poet said in our reading today, it's one of my favorite poems, very thick, that's why I printed it in the order of service, so I hope you can take it home and read it again. But as Stafford concludes, the darkness around us is deep. Doubt also provides a necessary corrective to our human tendency towards infatuation and immediacy. Doubt is what prevents us from following the wrong God home and missing our star. Doubt keeps us free from homogenized religion and idolatrous belief. And it keeps our focus as individuals on concerns that are truly ultimate, concerns that achieve expression differently in our individual lives. So by understanding faith as a dynamic and ongoing process, and doubt as a healthy response to the endless ambiguity of life, I know that the challenges that I have faced and the blessings that I've received are not barriers to my faith at all, but rather opportunities to develop my faith. Getting lost on the road of life can be frustrating and painful, but it also allows us to see more of the countryside. To know our spirits freed from the prison chains of willful purpose and perpetual control. I speak for experience when I say that sometimes not having a map is the best way to learn your way around. This brings me to another interesting faith language, leap of faith. I think it's interesting. I think it's become confused in our culture. Faith does not occur before the leap, which is kind of what we all assume. It's actually the result of the leap, of having landed, however gracefully or awkwardly. Faith follows the leap. It's coming to know the wilderness in ourselves and around us. It's coming to know, as Roger described last week, that the wilderness is everywhere and it unites us with our environment and with our fellow people. So what does all of this have to say about our communities, about how we gather? If we understand faith to be a process, not a destination, and if we accept that existential doubt is a healthy response to the darkness of ambiguity that surrounds us all, then what is the purpose of a congregation? Why do we come together if not around shared belief? As Tillich asked us 50-plus years ago, how is a community of faith even possible without the suppression of the autonomy of the individual's spiritual life? These are huge questions that have occupied the guardians and leaders of liberal religion for the better part of 2,000 years, so my answer will probably disappoint you today. Nonetheless, I want to propose one idea, one emerging purpose of liberal religious communities, and there are certainly many of them, and that's to create and cultivate a sense of religious expression and a culture of poetic listening. As you use, we have some growing yet to do here as a denomination. For the past 30 years or so, and I think this is true of our culture as well, widespread, we've restricted our use of language in our congregations. In an effort to remove language that is any way objectionable, surely a noble intent, we've unwittingly left ourselves with a stunted vocabulary. For example, and I'm grateful to learn, having only been here 3 weeks, that this doesn't really happen as much here at the fellowship as it may at other congregations. Many of you today struggle to claim the use of the word God. Whether or not you choose to believe in any particular kind of God, the fact remains that for thousands of years, God has been the central symbol for that ultimate concern. To simply remove it from our religious vocabulary would be like removing constitution or democracy from our national vocabulary. Amidst conflict, the temptation to abandon conflictual vocabulary is strong, but in matters of the heart, we do so at our own peril. As Tillich reminds us, the language of ultimate concern is always symbolic. I'm going to say that again for emphasis. The language of ultimate concern is always symbolic. It's always poetic. Like art, it arises out of unique struggles and celebrations. Human attempts to capture the essence of existence, no matter how earnest or how well supported by religious authority, they are always limited. They are fingers pointing at the moon, but never the moon itself. When we confuse our fingers with the moon, we have become idolatrous. We have accepted a faith external to us, a concern less ultimate than that of our heart's true decree. I want to share with you a piece of my poetry. It's not verse, but a metaphor, an image. It's something that actually developed when I was doing a wedding. It was out in the Minnesota woods. It was at a national park. You'll hear that. The night is cool and dark. In the center of the darkness is a fire. There are people gathered around the fire. Some sit alone, others prefer company. Some stare into the flame. Others warm themselves and then back away. They're all headed somewhere. A destination unknown awaits them all. Somewhere out there in all that darkness. Maybe they will leave in the morning, maybe in a week's time. But while they are together, they look out for one another. They take turns tending the fire. They swap stories of where they've been and share visions of where they will go. They know that this won't last forever. They know that there are others still in the dark. They were once there too. Like I said, this image just kind of has been floating around in my inside somewhere for months now. And it first came to me when I began a communal prayer at this wedding. And I said, God, who calls us together like cold campers around a fire. It made sense given the physical environment, but I think it struck a chord with me in something deeper. Our congregations are a lot like campfires. Surrounded by darkness and by the uncertainty of light, there's a warmth, a light, in a place of shared concern that is tended by us and enjoyed by us. A place where the weary and the lost are welcome, where seasoned travelers exchange stories. A place where we sing songs and celebrate and where we comfort one another. Even in the darkness, no, especially in the darkness, light achieves a certain gravity. Warmth achieves a certain presence, like good company. We, the congregation, are the campers in this metaphor, but we are not the flame. The flame is the collected warmth of our lives, all of our hopes and dreams endowed with the scientific and mystical wonder of our creation. Some may call it God, others may not. Perhaps love or spirit of life is more comfortable to you. Tillich called it ultimate concern. And what I would suggest is it's of little consequence what we call the flame. What matters is that we call the flame something, and that we tend it together. We should remain open to the many names for it, for the many ways of interacting with it. We should remain open to the knowledge that we are equals in the face of the darkness that surrounds us. This kind of equality requires of us not political correctness, but real relationship. Not categorical thinking, but acceptance and honesty. No matter the identity of the person next to you, no matter their observable characteristics, we all must face the darkness. Death knows no privilege. A few years ago, a young minister wrote into the UU World and I think rather brazenly submitted that Unitarian Universalism had little to offer until it had something to say to the dying. He was writing about a lack of existential commitment that he observed, that our ministers in other denominations can offer faith beyond this life in a way that UUs cannot. His submission garnered the response of an older, experienced minister who responded with a careful suggestion of what UUs should say to the dying. His suggestion was to say, "Hello, I'm from the church." If you don't immediately see the power of this seemingly casual response, I encourage you to let it sit with you for a while, as I have. In the poetry of the campers, we might say, "I'm from the campfire." And what would that mean? To me, it would mean that this person cared about me, knowing full well of the courage required in facing the darkness, the mystery, having faced it themselves, and that he or she would honor the ambiguity in my journey and the poetry of my experience. He or she would allow me to use my language as best as I could to express myself and would not force me into pre-existing molds. And so a campfire has something to teach us about pastoral care. The campfire is also a place of common experience, even and especially amidst difference. We've all stared into a fire before, lost ourselves in the rolling colors and the sounds of crackling embers. But we all see something different in the flames. Some would describe the fire as hot, others as red or orange, still others as alive or scary, exciting or life-giving. The reality, of course, is that this common flame is all of these things, and yet none of these impressions adequately describe the fire, nor is any one articulation of any more importance or value than another. The same must hold true in our congregations. We must hold reverently all aspects of life. We must see in our common essence the fire of social commitment, while also appreciating the underlying smolder of spiritual growth and self-deepening. And I want to commend you all on your underlying smolder right now. We must respond when called upon by the fire of our mutual commitment. When given honor and a task, we must burn hot when called upon to act out of conscience, but we must also warm one another gently when we ache, when we have been made weary by our travels. We must lose ourselves from time to time in singing and laughter and in staring into that fire. And finally, the campfire of liberal religion, to me, is a place of common commitment, of common purpose and common promise. We all take comfort in nurturing that which brings light and warmth to our lives, and we all have a role to play in sustaining it. This means that even something as seemingly mundane as congregational board meetings are actually imbued with a sense of purpose that calls us beyond our own survival as an institution. We are all on journeys, some in groups and some alone, and there are many more travelers in the world whose paths have yet to cross our own, but who could use a place of warmth and light and connection. The purpose of the liberal congregation, then, is to kindle in ourselves and others a light that exposes false divisions for what they are, and a warmth that encourages love and social healing. And so it is this way, this poetic way of being together, this way of gathering, that is our bond. My spiritual home is not one of wood and glass, Rather, my spiritual home exists wherever people convene in this certain way. Wherever the spirit of religious freedom welcomes strangers from the dark. Wherever the fire of common concern is tended with care and reverence. Wherever we may practice our language of commitment with curiosity and with courage. And wherever the stuff of life, the joys and concerns, laughter and sorrow, hopes and doubts, have the potential to become the foundation of a dynamic and vibrant faith. Which way is home? This way is my home, the way of free and liberal religion.